Greetings to all the constant listeners out there. It is coming up now in late April, and that means in western Pennsylvania, at least, the weather is starting to turn for the better. It's been a long winter, and we're really looking forward to spring. Hope you're enjoying it as well and getting some yard work done. This is the Far Middle Podcast, of course. You're listening to Nick Deolius. We are on episode 49. And for our dedication for number 49, we could have gone with Ron Louisiana Lightning Guidry of Yankees fame, right? Certain would be a worthy honoree. Or we could have gone with a pair of knuckleballers in baseball, Tim Wakefield and Charlie Howe, both of them donning the number 49. But we covered pitchers in the strikeout last episode in 48. And we've got, I think, a very fitting worthy honoree in football for episode number 49. Thus, this episode is going to be dedicated to the great Bobby Mitchell. Now, I hope you're not listening to that and then thinking to yourself, Bobby who? If you are asking that, here's an opportunity to learn about a great player who broke a lot of new ground a number of different ways in the NFL in the 1960s. And of course, the Far Middle Podcast is all about the constant listeners learning through tuning in. So Bobby Mitchell attended college at Illinois. He was a football as well as a track standout. He was drafted by the Cleveland Browns, a late draft pick in the seventh round in 1958, and his first position was halfback. And he was also a kickoff and punt returner and did an absolutely fabulous job at both while playing those positions along with halfback. He was originally paired with a guy in the backfield by the name of Jim Brown. You might have heard of him from the Cleveland Browns. And those two were in the running back field from 1958 to 1961. So you had Bobby Mitchell at halfback and Jim Brown at fullback. If you were an opposing defense facing the Browns during that era, yikes. And by the time he left the Browns in 1961, Bobby Mitchell held a team record for kickoff returns for touchdowns and also the team record for rookie rushing yards per carry. The mark was well over 6 yards a carry that he posted his first season. I believe that second record, that rookie rushing yards per carry mark, it still stands for the Browns to this day. Now, Mitchell was eventually traded from the Browns to the Redskins, and the circumstances he was traded under were really interesting. The Redskins were the last team in the NFL to integrate racially, and they did that in 1962. They were also under a lot of pressure from the federal government to do so. So I'm guessing, and I guess you could imagine this, right? It was a hugely poor optic when the professional football team in the nation's capital refused or wouldn't field black players. That's not a good look at all. So in the end, the Redskins drafted Ernie Davis from Syracuse, who won the Heisman that year, but they were afraid that his salary demands would be excessive, so they ended up trading him to the Browns for Bobby Mitchell and another player. Now, of course, Ernie Davis tragically developed leukemia. He passed away before he was ever able to play a down in the pros. It's an unbelievable story as to what happened to him. But in the event with the trade, Mitchell ends up becoming one of the first three black players on the Redskins in 1962. And the Washington team, of course, was the last NFL team, as I said, to integrate racially. Obviously, Bobby Mitchell played a key role in that. And he moved to receiver when he was in Washington, and he thrived at that position. He had 1,000-yard seasons as a receiver. He still continued to return kicks and did an unbelievable job at that job. And his coach for a while in Washington was a guy by the name of Otto Graham, another Browns great who was head coach of the Washington Redskins at the time. And he moved Bobby Mitchell back to the running back position at halfback. Then in 1969, another guy you might have heard of became coach of the Washington football team. His name was Vince Lombardi of Packer fame. And when he became coach of the Redskins, he wanted to move Mitchell back to the flanker position, back to wide receiver. But at that point in time, Mitchell did a self-assessment of his career and said, you know what, it's time for me to retire. And he did. And when he retired, he became a scout for Vince Lombardi and for the Washington team. And eventually he became an assistant general manager. So he had a nice career after his playing days on the gridiron with respect to front office positions. Now, Tom Boswell, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Tom Boswell. He's a really good sports columnist. I've always enjoyed his work out of the Washington Post. So he covered the Washington Redskins for years. And when Bobby Mitchell, I believe it's when Bobby Mitchell passed away a couple of years ago, he wrote a story on how great he was during his day. And he referenced and referred to Mitchell as a four-way threat. And he pointed out, rightfully so, Boswell did, that no player in the history of the NFL was among the best during his time at receiving, at rushing, at kickoff returns, and at punt returns, which is absolutely true. And Boswell called Mitchell a group photo of one. I thought that was a pretty cool descriptor for Mitchell, a group photo of one, because he truly was. You could have sported a whole offensive team with respect to all the skills that he brought to the field. So who is the only NFL player with more than 500 career rushes and 500 receptions to average more than 5 yards per carry and more than 15 yards per catch? The answer is Bobby Mitchell. Bobby Mitchell, constant listeners, was Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders before there was a Bo Jackson and a Deion Sanders. Now, I just rattled off a bunch of statistics about the great Bobby Mitchell. Statistics are sort of a guilty pleasure of mine, but so is surveys. And not just the results of surveys, but I also enjoy trying to drill down and understand how the survey was constructed, how it was designed, how it was performed by the entity that was providing it. I think you can learn a lot when you start to look at the devil in the details of surveys. Now, CNBC, whose parent, of course, is NBC, which isn't the most objective news organization out there, but CNBC did a recent survey. And there were two takeaways. One was President Biden's approval rating. That was coming out at an all-time low of 38%, which wasn't a shock. If anything, I guess I was surprised it was as high as 38%. I saw another poll recently that had it as low as 33%. But what got most of my interest was the second thing that this survey produced, which was a ranking of issues of top concern from the respondents. And the list was the first thing to me that was the most intriguing. Here was the order of concerns. Number one was cost of living. Number two was the war in Ukraine. Number three was border security. Number four, jobs unemployment. Number five was crime. Number six and number seven, the last two on the list, were climate change and coronavirus. They were very close to one another at the bottom there, within a percentage point or two of each. Now, again, these are the order based on a specifically designed survey, which was designed with respondents picking two items from the list that NBC came up with, which I think impacts and skews the results, but I'll get to that in a second. So a couple of observations that I had when viewing and going down this list. First, something like climate change being down towards the bottom of the list at 18%, which again was slightly higher than pandemic at the very bottom. And I think what you see there is you see respondents, and this makes sense, it's logical, it's rational, basically applying very straightforward common sense, saying, I'm going to be much more concerned about issues, pain, harms that are occurring today, that are very tangible, that are very real, that I can feel, taste, and experience the pain from in the current moment, versus concerns or risks that might be out in the future, might be somewhat abstract, it might be very difficult, if not impossible, to accurately project or predict down the road, like future climate. Another observation that I had was looking at this list and thinking about how things are interconnected. And what I mean by that, when I see climate change, that to me, I always think through, is it climate that I'm worried about and climate change and the changing future weather patterns, et cetera? Or is it climate change policies which pose the greater risk? And of course, as you know, if you've listened to prior episodes of The Far Middle, I'm greatly concerned about certain aspects of climate change policies. When I think of climate change policies, to me, they are equivalent. They're de facto energy policies. And energy policy is fundamental to all kinds of different aspects when it comes to quality of life across societies and economies. We know that. And I start to think about which aspects of quality of life across economies and societies energy policy impacts. And guess what? They're the very items that were listed very high on that survey. You think about climate change policies and energy policies, if they're not well designed or if there's key components of them that are not well thought out, they absolutely, we know this today in 2022, they will stoke inflation and raise cost of living. They will absolutely lead to disruption in the free market when subjective winners and losers are selected across industries or regions, which will create job losses. They will impact geopolitics because they will raise or increase the price of things that entities like Russia produce And when it creates that scarcity and raises the prices of those scarce products or commodities, that creates balance of trade leverage for somebody like Vladimir Putin. It also creates geopolitical leverage via energy security or energy insecurity in the case of the EU that will embolden someone like Putin and create situations like the Ukraine. And of course, looking at something like crime, when you have job losses and cost of living is getting out of control and you have geopolitical risk, that isn't going, those things are not going to do positive things with respect to crime trends. We're also experiencing that today. So for me, it was interesting to see that list. I saw climate change and I'm wondering, is that climate change or climate change policies? Climate change policies are equivalent to energy policies. If you get those things wrong or you get certain components of the overall policies wrong in a bad way, that can lead to a lot of the symptoms and problems that we saw way up higher on that list from CNBC. Third observation goes back to that guilty pleasure I spoke about. How was this survey designed? As I said, the respondents were picking two items off that list. But what would have happened if they could have only picked their top concern, only one item? I wonder if climate change would have even shown up on the survey results. I'd love to see what would have been the outcome if the survey were conducted that way. But again, I suppose like many surveys, this one was constructed a certain way under a certain design to ensure that a favored view or a favored cause or issue would remain on the chart and remain on the public radar and consciousness, sort of like the Ministry of Truth with George Orwell in 1984. So using these surveys to connect to the next dot, why might President Biden's approval be so low at 33 or 38%, depending again on the poll that you look at? Well, we just discussed that wall of worry, those list of concerns, right? And we saw things like the war in the Ukraine, border security. We talked about how climate change leads to climate change policies, which leads to energy policies, which leads to national security, all these things adding up to national security. And that got me thinking about something else I saw recently, and it dealt with Afghanistan and the Taliban. And what I saw just made me shake my head in dismay, and I wanted to share it with you. First, a little bit of context. If you go back to August of last year, during that time, that's when the Taliban, they were rolling across the nation of Afghanistan. It was inevitable that they were going to take over. And at that time, the White House press secretary said that the Taliban needed to, and I'm going to quote on this, to make an assessment as to what they wanted their role to be in the international community, end quote. Now, we all sort of laughed at that one. You laughed at it. I laughed at it because we all know that the Taliban does not care about its role in the international community. They could not care less. They are quite, I guess, what you would call the Afghanistan First movement, the originators of it. So since the Taliban didn't so much seize power as much as they did just fill a vacuum of power that was created when we left, what have they been up to? Well, there is a government ministry now. It is the Ministry for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. Now, that sounds like something you might find on an elite college campus these days. But anyway, this ministry has now instituted the following rules. First, girls and women can't receive secondary or college education. Two, women cannot fly on a plane without a male chaperone. Three, women can't make a road trip that is more than 45 miles in length. And fourth, women can only go to public parks on female-only designated days. Nice. And all this is real. I'm not making any of this up. Now, these new rules come out from the ministry that the Taliban has instituted. What has our White House said? What did it have to say about this new development and what it betrays as to how the Taliban assess their place in the international community? Here's the quote from the White House recently. Taliban are not living up to the essential commitments they made to the Afghan people and to the international community, end quote. Seriously, that is our leadership these days. That's the same leadership, right, that probably along with entities like the United Nations or the World Bank, IMF, et cetera, that are probably thinking when it comes to Afghan women that climate change is a bigger risk to them today than what's going on with the Taliban and its ministry. We deserve better. Afghans deserve better. But this is what we got, ladies and gentlemen. These dismal approval ratings for President Biden, it looks like it's starting to annoy and get even to the first dog. The first dog's name, by the way, is Major. You see, the first dog, Major, he likes to attack and bite Secret Service agents, which I suppose becomes a bit of a problem since both of those, the Secret Service agents and Major, they have to cohabitate around the White House on a daily basis. So Major, he ends up biting agents on 8 consecutive days. Now, that's a bad dog. I'm not going to complain anymore about my dog's behavior. I guess it could be a lot worse. And all of this, the incidents of biting the agents and what's going on with Major, all of this is coming to light under the Freedom of Information Act. I'm reading up on this. I don't know if you saw this story or not. And guess what? The White House press secretary only spoke about one incident, one biting incident, not 8. And on the incident that they did speak on, they made it sound like the Secret Service agent was in the wrong by surprising the first dog. And they called the injury minor. It turns out, when you look at these communications between the Secret Service agents under the Freedom of Information Act, that there were numerous incidents. There was a serious injury from the one bite, and the attacks were not provoked. They were unprovoked. So, you know, this was sort of amusing when I first started to read it, you know, reading about Major and what's going on with Major getting irate and biting Secret Service agents. But the more I read into this, you know, the more concerned, the more troubled I became, because this shows an issue with respect to truthfulness and veracity, where the press secretary sort of fibs on things like the severity of a bite or the number of times the dog bit Secret Service agents or the root causes of what ensued with respect to the bites. And you don't get the full story. Supervisors in the Secret Service, it comes to light, are telling agents to tone down their language in their reports when they're sort of documenting what happened and trying to create a certain visual or a spin versus what actually occurred. Now, what's interesting about this is that if a company, let's say in the energy or manufacturing space, did this with something like a safety incident on the factory floor or out there in the operations of the energy company, the supervisor that was performing the fabrication and basically the falsification would likely be terminated. They would lose their job, and rightfully so. But this is the real world that I'm talking about when it comes to manufacturing and energy and safety with respect to the workplace, not the political world where fiction looms larger than the fact when it comes to things like the Secret Service and Major and the White House press secretary, which is, I guess, amusing, alarming, sad. All of them together is how I would maybe sum it up. Someone please maybe give Major a chill pill, or maybe just lie to him, tell him that his master's approval ratings are double what they actually are to calm him down. Either way, how about us as citizens, how about the American public, starts to demand that the White House stop fibbing about the silliest or smallest of matters so we can start a process and build a process of trust on what they're telling us when it comes to much, much more pressing matters that are out there today. Now, speaking of politics and political theory, I recently posted an essay commentary on nickdeolias.com. You can check it out under the commentary tab that discusses an increasingly important question, a liberal or leftist, what's the difference? The answer to that question is everything. And a really bad habit has been developing across society the past couple of years. That is lumping together two things that are very different. In fact, they're so different that further reflection reveals the two things are nearly opposites. Yet people far and wide, they keep interchanging them as if they're the same thing. And again, this problem relates to confusing a liberal with a leftist. They are most definitely not synonymous. Our nation needs more of the former, more liberals, and to recognize the sinister danger that's growing with the latter, the danger of the leftist. So embrace the liberal and reject the leftist. Why? Why would I argue that you do that? Well, you can just do a compare and contrast. A liberal is a champion and defender of individual rights. And I think the best illustration of that is how a liberal will staunchly defend the right to free speech, freedom of expression, those types of things. And a true liberal values the Bill of Rights as much as the Constitution itself, because it recognizes that without the protection of individual rights that you find in the Bill of Rights, other protections for citizens that are found in the Constitution, they're not going to matter much in the end. Meanwhile, a leftist views individual rights as a threat. something to be suppressed to benefit the collective. And that's why leftists display an affinity to censor and shut down, shout down, strangle dissenting opinions and conflicting views across the public square, across the academic quad, across the media newsroom, all those things. And it's all being done, of course, under the official banner of protecting the public from things like hate speech or misinformation. Another compare and contrast, a legitimate liberal is a proponent of capitalism because they recognize the value creation and personal achievement. Those things benefit the individual as well as the market economy. And yeah, a lot of liberals favor more government regulation of economic activity than a conservative or a libertarian. That's certainly true. But nevertheless, the virtues of a free market economy are very obvious to the liberal. A leftist, on the other hand, abhors capitalism, hates it, and instead insists on a command economy where the state is going to dictate capital allocation and industry winners and industry losers. Leftists adhere to either socialism or communism, depending on the facts and circumstances of the situation. Another compare and contrast, a liberal supports the concept of the nation state, right? A liberal recognizes that citizens are members of distinct nations, unique cultures with unique attributes, formal borders, national sovereignty. Those things are to be respected. A leftist, anti-nationalist, people aren't citizens of a nation. Instead, people are members of the global community. Borders don't matter and, in fact, should be disregarded. Leftists don't differentiate by national identity. Instead, they tend to differentiate by class. So if you've been mistakenly mixing and matching your liberals and leftists, don't be too hard on yourself. You're not alone. I've been guilty of it myself in the past. Media talking heads, political pundits, and all these self-proclaimed reliable sources, they're doing the same. They're confusing these things on a regular basis. And it's time to get a little more organized and a little more discreet with how we're using terminology. Now, when I was composing this commentary and this essay, I came across another thought that I wanted to connect with you, which is how people tend to trust as the absolute truth or the gospel truth internet sources such as Wikipedia, which in fact are inherently biased. And the best example I can give you, this came out of a result of writing this this essay up on liberals versus leftists. Because if you go to Wikipedia and you search list of American liberals, what you come up with is a list of politicians. And if you peruse that list, you're going to find that Bernie Sanders, along with Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren and Mayor Pete, who's our transportation secretary, they appear on that list. Bernie Sanders, ladies and gentlemen, is a dyed-in-the-wool leftist, so much that he spent his honeymoon in the USSR back in the day. Labeling Bernie Sanders as a liberal, that's an insult to liberals, and it gives more credit to Sanders than he deserves. That serves as yet another illustrative warning to those who assume if you read it on a place like Wikipedia, it must be accurate and balanced, not necessarily true. Now, I wrote this this commentary because this difference between liberals and leftists in the confusion with discerning liberals from leftists, it's wreaking havoc on a lot of things, including the workings of the Democratic Party. And that's creating party-wide dysfunction. So what is in fact an internal party civil war between the liberal core and the leftist extreme wing of the Democratic Party has been inappropriately mislabeled, whether it's been inappropriately mislabeled by negligence or by intention, I don't know. But mislabeled as a battle between moderates and liberals. That is not what's going on with the Democratic Party, because a moderate is someone falling between classic conservative and liberal philosophies, not somebody sitting on an imaginary spectrum between a liberal and a leftist. Senator Manchin, President Clinton, those are liberals and certainly not leftists. Where they sit on the moderate liberal spectrum, yeah, that's an interesting question. It's going, I'm sure, to be subject to endless debate, but that is a different matter altogether. Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, she's a leftist and certainly not a liberal. Yet all one hears about when you read the paper or watch the news is how Manchin is the moderate emblem of the Democratic Party and Ocasio-Cortez is its liberal emblem. That's an apples and oranges mixing of terms that really muddles the overall real situation. So please, if you get a chance, give the commentary, the essay a read if you have some time on nickdeolias.com. I think you'll enjoy it. Now, speaking of the left, let's move to another topic. The culmination of various policies pushed by leftists that are now sort of on the controls of government. So you see this with pandemic shutdown policies, Fed policies, talked about energy policies, work policies, and overall, just generally speaking, the regulatory state. They have created a situation that what is known now in the capital markets as TINA. And TINA, T-I-N-A, is not a someone as much as it is a something, as in there is no alternative. TINA, there is no alternative. Get it? And I am surprised that the equity markets have held up as well as they have in 2022. And I know 2022 has been really volatile for stocks, and it hasn't been the greatest year when it comes to equity performance. But the indices actually, on all things considered basis, have done quite well when you look at the headwinds that are facing the markets. So why has that occurred? Like, why am I surprised that it's held up as well as it has? Well, it's because of what we call TINA. And consider where we are on other investment options besides stocks. And you'll see there is no alternative or TINA in action. So think of things like putting your cash in savings. Interest rates that the bank is going to pay you are way, way, way below inflation, meaning that you're going to end up on a real basis paying the bank to park money in an account, not the other way around. So you can't sit on cash. It eliminates that option. How about investing in fixed income and bonds? Well, they're both getting pummeled now with rising interest rates, with the Fed trying to catch up, coming late to the game with respect to controlling inflation. So fixed income and bonds, there's danger there, and investors are staying away, and the ones that are in there have been suffering losses. How about real estate? That's been a hot market that a lot of entities and individuals have invested in, from personal homes to commercial real estate. Well, what was once the speculative favorite play is now facing more and more headwinds. Rising interest rates are going to be needed to fight inflation, but when interest rates go up, that means mortgages are not going to be free anymore. There's not going to be free money to borrow, and low commercial office occupancies are still a resultant hangover effect of the shutdown policies with respect to pandemic, and it's affecting, as we said in prior episodes, things like work ethic. And then you also have home values and real estate values that are already sky high. So all those things add up to danger lights that are flashing red when it comes to real estate. What about crypto? Maybe you want to buy Bitcoin or something like that. Well, who knows what happens there, and who knows whether it's the next greatest thing ever or the biggest scam ever. So that's a very risky alternative. All this creates a herd mentality on equities where everyone is rushing into and barging into the same piece of the possible portfolio pie, which are stocks. And that helps the stock indices in the short term, which also sustains a bubble in valuations and creates a magnificent risk if and when the TINA trade reverses. And with record high inflation, a shaky Federal Reserve trying to catch up on rates, recession risk looming, geopolitical risks in war, an unstable government budget, unsustainable debt levels, I'd be more than worried about Our Lady TINA. Well, let's talk about now our final dot to connect for this episode. I'm going to start reading you the lines of two lines to a song. The lines are, "Turn out the lights, the party's over. They say that all good things must end." So I think it's a fitting pair of lyrics for wrapping up an episode. Now, what are those lyrics from? Who penned those? Well, that was from Willie Nelson. But those two lines of a Willie Nelson song were made much more famous across a much wider audience than the outlaw country crowd by Dandy Don Meredith. Don Meredith, for those of you who remember him, was a professional football player for the Cowboys, but he really reached a new level of notoriety and fame when he became one of the broadcasters in the Monday Night Football broadcast booth along with Howard Cosell and team. And he would close out each game on Monday Night Football, and was getting towards the end of the game, by doing a rendition singing those lines of that Willie Nelson song. So what do I want to conclude with? I want to conclude with a thought on a book. And as many of you know that have listened to this podcast in the past, I love books. I love literature. George Orwell and John Steinbeck and Ayn Rand and Ernest Hemingway. I love them all. But I especially love Stephen King. And that, of course, is the writer that literary critics love to hate, that the elite love to disdain. But he is the favorite author of a lot of the unsophisticated and the uncultured, myself included. And I guess I'm proud to be part of that group, because I just love Stephen King. I started reading him when I was probably 14 years old, give or take, and I haven't stopped since. You think about some of the epic stories that he's created, The Stand and Salem's Lot and It, on it goes. Heck, just think of the movies that were made based on a lot of this guy's books. Okay, so you've got, of course, The Shining with Jack Nicholson. Stand By Me was a great movie. The Running Man with Schwarzenegger. Shawshank Redemption, another great one with Morgan Freeman. The Green Mile, right? Tom Hanks. Pet Sematary. Carrie, the original Carrie, at least, with Sissy Spacek. Thinner, The Stand, which became sort of a series at one point. Cujo. So on and on it goes. A lot of just stellar movies coming off of this guy's prolific career with what he was able to create as a writer. And recently, I got to say, and when I say recently, I'm probably talking about the last 15 years or so, I feel that Stephen King lost his touch. Something came off his fastball, so to speak. Didn't have the greatest stuff the past 15 years or so, or the greatest storylines, at least in my opinion. And you saw, I felt a lot of repetition, recycling from earlier stories. I sort of felt like he became one of those successful rock acts that had a real big hit record or single. And they were always constantly from there forward trying to recreate that album that sold really well, or that song, the sound of that song, and it just became stale. Plus, you know, Stephen King's politics, and he is political, they're a little bit different than mine on certain issues, maybe more to the left, not as much liberal. And he tends to preach, sometimes without preaching officially, in many of his stories and through many of his characters. I think President Trump also recently sort of pushed him over the edge in that regard. And I'm sure Stephen King's not alone with being triggered by President Trump. But I got to tell you, Stephen King is back because he hit an absolute home run with a recent book that I think came out just prior to pandemic. And the name of the book is The Institute. I'm not going to spoil it for you, so I'm not going to give you any of the storylines or plot lines. But if you like Stephen King, or if you like a good drama, give this book a read, The Institute. It is classic Stephen King with the characters and the plot. But what's really interesting about this one is the storylines underlying the book itself. I found them to be both intriguing and really timely in days like these. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think you will as well. And look, don't be ashamed with reading Stephen King or being seen reading him. Hey, if you know you like wine and you're a wine connoisseur, it's okay to enjoy some homemade wine from time to time. If you're a foodie, it's okay to indulge in a Big Mac once in a while. And if you like literature, a Stephen King novel now and then, it'll do you just fine. It'll do you well. Your elite friends might look down at you, but they probably do so anyway when no one's thinking or watching them. The heck with them. Give me my Stephen King. Plus, I don't think I have any elite friends anyway. They won't have me. That's a wrap on episode 49. We will talk soon. You have a great week in the interim.